For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
One of the things that made me realize that we really need to move on this is another analysis that we did on the Australian response to the pandemic. Amazingly, we did do very, very well, better than most other countries. But from a political science perspective, that has not been because of our government. It is in spite of our government.
That was Professor Evelyn Deleu, Director of the Centre for Health Equity Training Research and Evaluation at UNSW Sydney. She and her colleagues have written a perspective for the MJA, which focuses on the sustained and multiplied disadvantages of long COVID. In the article, they call for immediate and urgent planning to help disadvantaged and vulnerable communities to recover from COVID and long COVID, not in a piecemeal, haphazard way, but in a way which has a reliable and lasting impact. Dealing with the fallout of the pandemic, they write, will require a tangible commitment to deliver across sectors and for everyone. Unquote. Professor Deleu is my special guest today. You've co-authored a perspective for the MJA on long COVID and the sustained disadvantage that that's going to need some preparation for. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any of that preparation happening?
No, and that's why in dark corners of the internet, people say, look, this is a thing and we need to get prepared. Internationally, there are a few colleagues who have called attention to this and pushed the alert button, but I don't see any planning just yet. I fear that planning in the hands of our governments hasn't been particularly successful over the last 2 years.
All right, so let's talk about what you mean by long COVID. Are you talking about the actual medical, physical definition of it, or are you talking about other effects as well?
There is some codification of the medical term by WHO. There's a standard now what long COVID is. And yes, we are talking about that, although that still needs refinement and resolution. But really what we try to alert the world to, and in particular here in Australia, is that the effects of long COVID are distributed and unequally, unfairly distributed. So the clinical picture of long COVID may be very clear, but the effects of long COVID and the cascading impact on communities, that is something that we haven't seen codified at all yet. If you would say who suffers from long COVID, well, that is distributed as it is in the normal COVID pattern. But what we know is that more people in disadvantaged communities have suffered from COVID than in well-to-do communities. And the effect of long COVID is such that where their lives are already frail, disadvantaged, and challenged, the symptoms of long COVID will impact them more.
You talk about the frameworks that we can use to understand those consequences. You know, we've been talking about COVID-19 being unfair in the sense that it hits vulnerable populations, marginalized populations, disadvantaged populations. But it's a lot more nuanced than that, isn't it? There are frameworks we can use to really dig into that.
Aged populations, frail populations, people with comorbidities, overweight, obesity, immune system issues. Yes. But it also is the case that those people are more often found in disadvantaged communities.
Yes.
Aboriginal communities, refugee communities, ethnic communities that may not have full access or full, they may have full access, but not the full use of all the services that others have. So, you know, it is environments where people are in precarious jobs, are in crowded housing, do live in multi-generational households, have very low health literacy or are health literate, but get their information from Pakistan or wherever they are from, and try to deal with that information in a way that is not entirely compatible with the Australian system. So the clinical picture, of course, is the same. But the context, and that's what causes inequities, is very different.
The public discourse, particularly from the federal government, has been, oh, we've got to get back to normal. The sooner we get back to normal, the better, you know, live with COVID, blah, blah, blah. Is that realistic, do you think, without some planning?
Two things. First, in the first year of the pandemic, when we saw all sorts of creative responses, pop-up bicycle paths, and people enjoying life under a much quieter flight path, it was safer to go out because less traffic. You know, a lot of people in my area of the professional world, urban planners, political scientists, said, this is fantastic. This is the new world that we want. This is wonderful. So the new normal will be a better normal. And of course, we've seen across the board that people have said, let's try to return to the old normal or the new normal or whatever it is. Let's get it over with. Let's move beyond COVID. Now, I have already warned in a paper that I wrote about healthy cities and the pandemic that is not how the world works. So these disasters will have an impact. And let's call it what it is. It is a disaster. And they will change the world forever. But to change the world for the better, that is a huge challenge, and that takes commitment and energy and vision. And I don't think that is what we are willing to commit to. When you're out in the streets, the traffic jams are the same as before.
You've called for two actions, basically, in this paper. One is, it ain't over until it's over for everybody. And it's not. There's no point in us talking about it unless we're going to take meaningful action.
That's right.
Are you optimistic about either of those in the current political climate?
I should be. It is our responsibility as health professionals to be optimistic. If we weren't, then what's left to do? So I should be optimistic. And one of the things I have training, I have some training in political science, and I'm always amazed, if not baffled, when people say, there's a lack of political will. But the thing is, we create the people, the community creates political will. If we want other leaders to take different action, it is up to us to elect them. And particularly in the health system, we, our colleagues, the clinicians, the hospitals, the professional associations, we have the opportunity and the moral responsibility to create the political will to get better out of this than we were before. And knowing that, yes, I'm optimistic. At the same time, I do see that a lot of people would be challenged seeing that optimism and challenging me, saying, well, that's not very realistic. Yeah, nothing ever comes easy. So we have to stand up and we have to argue for things.
So wave your magic wand for me, Evelyn. What needs to happen now and what needs to happen 6-12 months down the track?
Yeah. So we need to be aware of the fact that already vulnerable communities will be affected more by long COVID. They, in addition to whatever new variant is out there and however long current variants are still moving through society, already vulnerable communities will be more vulnerable because of this. And we need to focus our resources, our attention, our diagnostic capability on those disadvantaged communities. And that is not just a matter of rhetoric, not just saying, oh yeah, we know that these people are suffering. No, this means, and that's the two models that I connect in my paper for the MJA, it's this model about determinants of health, and then a model about how you deal with equity or inequities in health. You need to not just name what's wrong, you need to take action on what's wrong. And for instance, if racism, it's the same discourse, racism, domestic violence, gender-based violence, if you want to change it, you have to do something about it. And for that reason, I would say, where's the first local health district or regional health authority that has an anti-racism unit? Where is a primary health network that says racism is our top priority? This is not a radical, strange idea on the edge of the believable. This is a determinant of health, and we need to take action. And it sounds like it has nothing to do with long COVID, but it has everything to do with long COVID.
I'm chatting today with Evelyn DeLieu, Director of the Centre for Health Equity Training Research and Evaluation at UNSW Sydney. Her co-authored perspective can be found at mja.com.au, where it is open access. The full link to the article is in the show notes of this podcast. Meanwhile, if you want to catch up with past episodes, you can find them at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are free to access. To ensure you never miss an upcoming episode, you can subscribe to our feed on Spotify, Apple Music, Audible, and Amazon Music. Back to our chat. What is the Progress Plus protocol?
In medical science, and particularly in systematic reviews, people love acronyms.
Yes.
So Progress Plus, and I have to read that out. Of course, that doesn't roll off the tongue naturally.
No.
is one of those acronyms. And Progress stands for place of residence. So where you live matters for your health. Place of residence, race and ethnicity, occupation. Where you work and how you work there matters for your health. Gender, religion, education, social capital, connectedness, trust in others, socioeconomic status. We all know about the social gradient on which health is distributed. And then plus, this is the progress. And then plus, age, disability, and sexual orientation. And in a way, it is an acronym for the Whitehead model. With all the beautiful rainbow nestedness.
Is that easy to translate into something that politicians and policymakers can wrap their heads around?
I would think so. I'm tempted to say I'd hope so, but I think so. Because it does have immediacy for, and I mentioned that before, organizational development. If you want to make this a fair society, these are the things that potentially make us an unfair society. And if you want to address those things, you can invest in them. And I had an interesting conversation last week where we were considering developing a center of excellence in equity or inequality. And someone, an economist, said the easiest thing that you can change is income distribution. You change taxes, and then an income is a predictor or a driver of inequity and inequality. Now, there is no I in progress. So, you know, income, yes. But what really drives income inequality, unfairness, is all the rest. You know, the place of residence, race, ethnicity, occupation, gender, religion, education, social capital, and socioeconomic status. And yes, then yes. How you live those factors.
If you had all the money and power in the world, what would you do first?
I would really reappraise where we put our money, because, you know, I just talked about income being a predictor. Well, but the distribution of resources in society is a very important predictor of how you do things. And, you know, we are based in southwestern Sydney, or one of Danny Hinch is in western Melbourne. Those are both fairly disadvantaged communities, and we know that both of those areas receive less money than other areas per head, per capita. So I would really challenge governments, local governments, state governments, but certainly also the feds, to recognize that they have different responsibilities for primary care and hospitals and all that, to reappraise how money is allocated to particular services. And do that in a very diversified, bespoke way, and say, look, some populations need more than others. Again, the rhetoric is big on this. Proportionate universalism. Some people need more of the same than others. It's a little bit more complicated than just that. And to have a nice algorithm, and actuarians, for instance, know exactly how to develop those algorithms and say, this is where you need more money. This is where you need to invest it. And this is how long that investment needs to happen, rather than piecemeal investments through whatever pork barrel you can imagine. So sustained, well thought through planning is my magic wand.
I'm a journalist, not a medical professional, so I am inherently pessimistic. But I don't feel like it's particularly a good environment to get people to look at disadvantaged populations and see what can be fixed.
I hear what you say. The climate is not necessarily great. And yes, that is true. I'm part of a partnership between the University of New South Wales and ACOS and the Poverty and Inequality Partnership. And we did a study, published a study about income inequality in health last year. And amazingly, what we tried to do initially was to map health inequities in Australia. And we could not find quickly surveyable, easily digestible information on the outrageous health inequities that you see in Australia. If you handpick the data, in the north of Australia, in Arnhem Land, the median age of death is 55, 56. In Sydney's Northern Beaches, the median age of death is 85. That is 30 years difference in the same country. We are a developed, and we all often claim, welfare state. And this is outrageous that in certain parts of that same welfare state, people live on average 30 years shorter than in other parts. We have the resources and the capacity, the knowledge, the know-how to fix that. And yes, I agree with you. Our current politics tend to focus on prosperity, focus on productivity, on economic recovery rather than health and well-being recovery. And if you look at the, and now I'm getting really on my hobby horse. If you look at the World Health Organization, that has shifted from health to well-being and hinging itself on a thing called the well-being economy. And you might think, oh, that's some fancy fantasy. No, it's not. There are very clear environments and evidence on how well-being economies work for the general well-being and equity around the world. New Zealand, very, very well thought through. Wales, for instance, the Finns are moving toward it. There's been a big statement from the World Health Organization recently about health promotion and the well-being economy. If we want to be part of civilization and the real world, we need to hinge ourselves on that development. I'm not alone. There's many of my colleagues who truly believe that this is an opportunity.
Most of our listeners are GPs. Is there a message for primary care in this? What can people do at the coalface for their vulnerable patients?
First of all, I think, and I mentioned this, all doctors have a moral responsibility to use their position of power, and let's recognize it. Doctors Yep. have positions of power to advocate for better health and well-being and better equity. So that's one of the things that I call anyone to do, and in particular GPs, because in their communities they play such an important role. And we've seen that here in Sydney with local GPs organizing their communities and offering communities the opportunity to get vaccinated, to organize themselves, to create access to food banks, to directly work with disadvantaged populations. I think the advice that you need to give them, or a prescription, is activism. Mm-hmm. Organize yourself and make yourselves heard. Of course, there is the clinical intervention that is important. People need to be healthy and as healthy as possible. But there's more to that, to make people resilient, to actually invest in not the individual or how their body will be healthier, but how their future will be healthier. And I think that GPs are supremely responsible and supremely placed to advocate for that. One of the things that made me realize that we really need to move on this is another analysis that we did on the Australian response to the pandemic. And that, amazingly, we did do very, very well, better than most other countries. But from a political science perspective, that has not been because of our government. It is in spite of our government. Our government has failed us on many, many counts, whether it came to vaccine procurement and distribution, whether it came to isolating people, lockdowns. The Australians have shown extraordinary resilience, not because of their government, but in spite of it. In dealing with long COVID, I think we have the same spirit and Australian battlers. Yeah. But I think we should be able to have a government that we deserve. And we have shown that we deserve a better government.
Evelyn, thank you so much. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.